direction in which the Chifley government was taking Australia. But as Robert Menzies of the newly formed Liberal Party found at the 1946 federal elections, the year, of course, in which the League was born, it was extremely difficult to defeat a Chifley government still basking in the memory of the popularity which had surrounded the former leader, the wartime leader, John Curtin. When elected, Chifley immediately started to set in motion a number of policies which really caused great national concern. There was nothing surprising to those who'd been studying Chifley's long background. He was a centralist. One of the first things he tried to do, of course, was to ensure that price controls introduced during the wartime period were made permanent, and so he had to have a referendum. The League, of course, was very much involved, and Chifley was defeated. Almost immediately following the rejection of his price control policy, Chifley launched the great bombshell concerning bank nationalisation. Now again, that shouldn't have been surprising to anybody that studied Ben Chifley's long record, going back to earlier legislation, the 1945 banking legislation, which prepared the way. He was concerned with increasing centralisation of power and saw banking as a major means of achieving that. This period was one when Australia had a large number of anti-socialist movements. There were literally dozens of them. There was even a woman's anti-socialist movement. There was the People's Union of New South Wales, headed by a former business leader, Mr. A.G. Hebblewhite, assisted by a former top communist, Mr. Tony McGillick, who subsequently became quite closely associated with the League. It was during this period that the League itself was very seriously regarded as a means by which people could obtain valuable information, and so it had a number of interesting subscribers to its journals. People, for example, like subsequently a minister in the Liberal government, Mr. Athol Townley from Tasmania, and many others. There were organizations like the Melbourne Constitutional Society, led by a Colonel MacArthur. One of the most prominent members of that society was a Mr. James Manson. Subsequently, James Manson became a minister in the Baltic government, and incidentally was a strong supporter of the League. In fact, he appeared on a number of League platforms. One would have to say that during this period, the League became what you'd almost describe as respectable, in the sense it was widely accepted as prominent in the anti-socialist campaign. As yet, the first sign of any smearing of the League was to emerge. Nevertheless, there were some anti-communist leaders that raised their eyebrows a little when the League suggested that a deeper understanding of communism required a grasp of who had financed the Bolshevik Revolution and was still sustaining the Bolsheviks. That was all to come later. During this period, it's very interesting reflecting on it, the League enjoyed the support of some of Melbourne's most prominent and most distinguished business leaders. I well recall one famous dinner held at the Federal Hotel. A large number of approximately 40 people were present, including people like Mr. George Folletta, very prominent in the business world, people like Sir Edgar Coles, the man who later was to become the Attorney General in the Baltic government, Sir George Reid, and many others. It was during this period the League also was cementing its relations with other people, Mr. John George of George's, and many others. In fact, if you'll run through that list of supporters, you'll find that practically every prominent business leader in Melbourne was at that time associated with the League in one way or another. Interestingly enough, the major organizational figure in the Associated Chamber of Manufacturers at that time, Mr. Latham Withall, was a long-term supporter, a personal friend, and also a man who had a rather thorough grasp of social credit. Also, during that period, when there was growing concern, there was growing relationships that had developed later with men like Sir Edmund Herring, subsequently Chief Justice of Victoria, whom I also came to know well as a fellow member of the Melbourne Anglican Synod, another member of the Supreme Court of Victoria, Mr. Justice Scholl, who also was of great support for the League. And so we could go on and list these many prominent figures. It's rather disgusting in one sense that we have political leaders today who smear the League and suggest that the League's a reprehensible sort of an organization when you look at many of the founding members. Members who had supported this nation in the war, distinguished war records, the first West Australian state director, Mr. Tom Baker, DFC winner. Here in Victoria, people of the caliber of Mr. William Manifold of the famous Western District pastoral family, DFC and Bar, and many others who had most distinguished war records, and to have these people described as reprehensible, that's bordered a little on the obscene. I suppose the kindest thing we can say is that, on that famous reference, Father forgive them, they know not what they do. It was during this period also that another development took place of the greatest significance, when I was introduced to the managing editor of the Melbourne Morning Conservative paper, The Argus, Mr. later Sir Errol Knox. He was interested in what I had to say, and that was during the bank nationalisation period. So he invited me to contribute an article which first appeared in the Melbourne Argus, November 1947, in which I stressed that bank nationalisation could not be understood except in the context of the assault on the federal constitution. That article made such an impression that I was invited to continue writing for the Melbourne Argus, and in fact was a feature writer on both national and international affairs right up until on the eve of the 1949 federal elections, when it should be recorded that suddenly those articles came to an end. The Melbourne Argus had been taken over by mirror interests in United Kingdom, socialist background, and the first act was to ensure that my article ceased. In fact, a series were already in course of being prepared and run when they were cut off. It was also during that period that interstate we had the support of prominent and distinguished Australians, South Australia, people like Sir Arthur Arimal, subsequently associated with the Bank of Adelaide, and also later a very prominent member of the upper house, Sir James Irwin. He was a long-time supporter of the League, also a member of the South Australian Legislative Council. Now, there's no doubt that the 1949 elections were a watershed in Australian history. There's little doubt that because of the events that have taken place, and because of the work that had been done, particularly by the League, that the Chifley government was defeated. It should be recorded that during this period, the League of Rights found itself in the position where it was, in essence, responsible for much of the anti-bank nationalisation campaign, myself being invited to run training courses for bank officers, and much else. And it was generally agreed that the League played one of the decisive roles in that period in Australian history. The Fadden Menzies government came to office with the famous slogan of putting the shillings back into the pound. Because immediately Ben Chifley, after his referendum on price controls, had taken off the consumer discounts, which had stabilised prices for many years, inflation roared ahead. So inflation was a major issue. The Menzies Fadden team promised, if elected, they would restore the consumer price control system that had worked so effectively. It should be recorded that we had direct access to some of the policy makers, particularly to Sir Arthur Fadden, and there's no argument in my mind that they intended to implement that policy. It wasn't long after the election result that it became clear that tremendous pressure was being applied to the new government to back away from that proposal. In fact, it's reliably reported that the major economic, or one of the major economic advisors, H.C. Coombs, a long-term Fabian socialist and a great supporter of centralised planning, was one of those who, in essence, made it clear to the new government that they are against the implementation of the policy and, in fact, almost threatened they wouldn't implement it even if instructed to do so. So the Menzies Fadden team backed away from that, and, of course, naturally, it wasn't long before inflation started to become a dominant factor in Australian politics. Business leaders became increasingly disturbed by the new government's failure to implement many of the policies they had anticipated would be introduced. Although bank nationalisation had been defeated, virtually by the courts, ruled out, it was quite clear that the centralised control of finance which had been established by the Chifley government was not going to be challenged. And the banks themselves were increasingly uneasy at what was taking place. It was in 1951 that I was invited by Mr. Withall, whom I've mentioned of the Associated Chambers of Manufacturers, to be available for a important meeting of top businessmen to be held in Brisbane to discuss the situation. It should be recorded it was about this time that the Menzies government was attempting to, in one sense, exploit the communist position, which admittedly was serious, leading up eventually to their famous referendum which sought to outlaw the Communist Party. It was during that meeting in Brisbane that a very interesting meeting took place in my hotel room between myself and Mr. Arthur Cresby, later to become a Liberal Member of Parliament and later a recognised authority on the Constitution, played a major role in the establishment of the League in Queensland, and contributed, I might say, a number of articles to the Argus during that period that Sir Errol Knox was favourably disposed towards the League. But also in that room with me and Arthur Cresby was another interesting man, Jim Killen, as he later, of course, was become Sir James Killen. That time he was a prominent member of the Young Liberal movement. And it was during that discussion that we made it clear to Jim Killen that the proposed anti-communist legislation by the Menzies government would drive serious wedges into the federal constitution. The long-term dangers were obvious. And one of the results was that as the senior member of the Young Liberals at that time, Jim Killen declined the campaign for a yes vote. Also, the League of Rights declined the campaign for a yes vote, which raised many eyebrows. In fact, it's fair to say the League lost temporarily a few of its anti-communist friends who took, in our opinion, the rather superficial view that by outlawing officially the Communist Party, we would be dealing with the basic problem, overlooking the fact we'd be creating even worse problems. So it's not surprising with that grave disquiet amongst the business community and many others that the Menzies referendum was defeated. Now, Dr. Abbott, the new leader of the Labour Party, was given much of the credit for leading that campaign, but the fact is there was a deep grassroots resentment now building up against the Menzies-Fadden government right through the community, so it wasn't surprising what took place. Labour under Abbott's leadership became quite erratic and took us right up to that crucial year, 1954. The League of Rights was prominent in constantly drawing attention to Abbott's background, his Fabian background, the associates of the Fabian socialist movement, and much else. The banks themselves continued to be very uneasy in the direction which they might be going, and were most concerned that perhaps an Abbott-led Labour government might easily continue on where the Chifley government had left off. My own view is that if it had not been for that explosive Petrov affair, when that top Soviet diplomat defected and exploded the news that, which to every informed person was not surprising, the Soviet espionage system had reached deep into the Australian community, there's little doubt, in my opinion, that Dr. Abbott would have been elected at the 1954 elections. But even so, as the elections drew clear and made it quite obvious, it was not going to be an easy win for the Menzies-Fadden government. The League felt we had no other alternative but to ensure, from the long-term point of view, that the Abbott challenge was defeated. So during that run-up to that elections, the League ran a number of very specialised campaigns in a number of what you might call swinging electorates, weekly radio broadcasts, newspaper material, and much else was all fed in the depth to influence the electors, at least to ensure we did not have an Evatt-dominated Labour government elected. Even so, it was quite clear that Menzies and Fadden were going to be in some trouble. And that is quite clear. What happened was, of course, they were elected, re-elected. We had the famous split in the Labour Party, with Dr. Evatt becoming openly erratic by now, and many wild allegations about sections of the Labour Party, particularly those fighting communism inside the trade unions, generally called the movement headed by actionists like Mr. Bob Santomir and others, and that produced the famous Labour Party split. And there's no doubt that that split did keep the Menzies-Fadden government in office in the years to come, skillfully exploited by Liberals and Country Party. They were able, on the preferences of the Democratic Labour Party, which was a split off from the Labour Party, they were managed to sustain themselves. But during that period, inflation continued, and the League constantly drew attention to it, pointing out that under orthodox finance economic policies of increasing debt and more taxation, it was mathematically certain that inflation would have to continue. And inflation meant, of course, social disorder, exploitation by the radicals, and much else. Which brought us then to 1961. Now, 1961, the inflation position had reached the stage that the Menzies-Fadden government, which had run a number of conferences and incredible discussions, even with church leaders, on what might be done morally about inflation, but they took the advice of the so-called experts, who knew only one answer to inflation, and that was a credit squeeze, to cut back the rate at which new credits were being fed into the system. That was the only answer they knew. Looking back, it's interesting to recall that up until 1961, Australia had basically what generally might be called full employment. The credit squeeze of 1961 produced unemployment of a rate which we would laugh at today, but it sent shockwaves through the whole of the Australian society, so much so that the Labour Party, led by Mr. Arthur Calwell, looked at one stage as if it would win the 1961 election. There was a massive backlash against the Menzies-Fadden government, the biggest backlash, incidentally, being in Queensland. It's part of folklore that the Menzies government was only saved by the last electorate to be counted or finalised in Queensland, Moreton, held by Jim Killen. It's certainly true that at one stage even Jim Killen looked as if he would be defeated. And there's a lot of mythology about the alleged claim that it was communist preferences that sustained him, which was rather ironic in view of his anti-communist background. The truth is that the Australian League of Rights ran a very specialised campaign in defence of Jim Killen in that campaign, making use of the telephone and much else, and there's little doubt that that did play perhaps the decisive role in his re-election. It's now a matter of history that immediately Sir Robert Menzies was re-elected, he reacted in a most dramatic manner. In fact, at his first cabinet meeting, he startled his colleagues by suggesting that what had to be done immediately was the introduction of a deficit budget. And the deficit he proposed was even greater than that had been proposed by Arthur Call to try and re-stimulate the economy. It is authoritatively recorded that when one of his colleagues said that, well, we're merely adopting what now Arthur Call was putting forward, Bob Menzies responded, well, if it's good enough for the majority of the Australian electors, it'll be good enough for us and next business, please. And so the Menzies government continued with the only policy the experts knew under orthodox finance of trying to ensure the economy was re-stimulated, and that was by credit expansion. Results were, of course, predictable. Now, it was during this whole period that another factor was starting to emerge in the public mind, and that was the threat of the United Kingdom joining the European Economic Community. Sir Robin Menzies had made it clear to the British Conservatives, who'd sent representatives out to Australia to brief him on the matter, that he was not particularly enthused by this. Being a great Commonwealth man, he could see the long-term dangers of fragmentation. But it was Jim Killen, who was the man that did the best in-depth examination of the long-term implications. And so Jim Killen became the focal point for a campaign in Australia, backed by the Australian League of Rights, constantly drawing attention to the fact that what was taking place was a manifestation of what the League had always been concerned about, that the end of the Second World War would see a continuation of a campaign to eventually disrupt and destroy the British Empire itself. Here was a clear manifestation of that. The League ran many meetings, it promoted a number of campaigns, and that resulted in 1962 with the raising of a special fund to send Jim Killen and myself to the United Kingdom to campaign against the common market. You might say to raise the flag, to demonstrate to the British public that the Australians were far from enthusiastic about a proposal which was going to divide and eventually break up the old British world. That fund was quite amazing in the sense that the League was able to fill the fund, we were able to finance it, and so amidst a great deal of controversy with Jim Killen being badly assaulted by the media with his association with now this awful League of Rights, that he should join with this in this campaign, which took place nevertheless. The League of Rights used the opportunity not only to campaign in the United Kingdom, where it made many contacts subsequently that were of great value in the expansion of the League. Numbered amongst these was some very important people. We had the Confederation of British Industries that virtually hosted us in that campaign. But also we had the support of men like Air Vice Marshal Donald Bennett of Pathfinder fame. Donald Bennett became a close supporter of the League. He appeared on a number of platforms with me, chaired a number of meetings, and I maintained a close contact with him until he died. Again, I draw attention to the strange claim that the League of Rights in some way was a reprehensible organization when had the support of men like to Donald Bennett, and many others, many prominent British leaders as the years went on. I took the opportunity of the visit to the United Kingdom to do a Commonwealth tour. So we took the message to first to Canada, where the man who subsequently became the National Rector of the Canadian League of Rights, Mr. Ron Gostick, hosted a tour right across Canada. I met with prominent political figures in Ottawa, sympathetic, concerned about the future of the British Commonwealth and the direction in which the British government and the so-called Conservatives was taking it. I went on then to New Zealand, where we had big meetings because New Zealand was very vulnerable to what was being proposed, because it relied to an enormous extent on the British market for the exports of its primary production, particularly dairy production. New Zealand has often been described as England's other market, or other part. I met with the New Zealand Prime Minister, Sir Keith Holyoake, and attempted to persuade him that he should personally go to New Zealand because of the very warm feeling in the United Kingdom about New Zealanders and their close association with Britain and campaign. Sir Keith was not, I regret to say, a man of great vision, and felt it might be unwise to create the impression he was interfering in the affairs, the internal affairs of the United Kingdom. I stress that the affairs of the United Kingdom were also the affairs of the whole of the British Commonwealth, and therefore it was essential that leaders in the Commonwealth indicate they were far from happy. The next year, 1963, it was agreed here in Australia, because of the grassroots work that had been done the previous year around the Commonwealth, that I should make another Commonwealth tour with a view to expanding what the League was about, to develop a grassroots movement amongst people of the old British Commonwealth into some type of coherent movement which could share its experiences and campaign together. That was 1963, and highly successful. I even took the opportunity to visit South Africa, and that country at that stage still known as Rhodesia, to outline my thinking concerning this matter. 1963. All through this period, the League, of course, was very prominent in the anti-communist movement everywhere, and it became increasingly clear to me that what we needed was not merely anti-communist rhetoric, propaganda. What we needed was some hardcore training, that we're engaged in a war for survival, and if we're going to win this war, we need to train for it. The result was the evolution of a training program, an anti-communist, or as it was later known, an anti-subversion seminar type of program, which would equip people with an in-depth understanding that the basic issue was philosophical, a cleavage between two points of view. And unless we understood what's called Marxism-Leninism, dialectical materialism, and much else, we weren't going to be very well equipped. That program was first tried in Canada in 1964 and produced one of the most incredible results, as Mr. Pat Walsh, former undercover agent with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and I traveled across Canada with a whole series of revolutionary activities. An amazing period, in the headlines every day. Require a whole book to describe that most remarkable campaign, which concluded way down the Maritimes, where even there, which I was assured was a nice, quiet part of Canada, the revolutionary ferment broke. In fact, it even reached the Canadian House of Commons, and the suggestion was that I should be deported from Canada as a dangerous influence. Later, it was subsequently discovered that the top hierarchy of the communist movement, once they grasped what this training program was about, reacted accordingly and said, in essence, while they didn't mind these anti-communists merely giving anti-communist speeches and circulating anti-communist literature, the concept of developing a hardcore training program of equipped people was something they saw as a tremendous danger and had to be destroyed before it even started. It was amazing to see the influence of the communists and their backers during this period. I well recall in Canada, for example, we even had one of the chambers of commerce proposing to conduct an anti-communist educational program. That program never even got off the ground because it was also seen as a great danger. Here was a suggestion we move beyond just straight education to an action program, and that had to be destroyed. As I say, it demonstrated that when you are in a state as we are of war, then you must equip yourself for war. This was a tremendous educational experience for many people, and back here in Australia, the campaign to smear the league was now stepped up. While it was quite clear earlier the league was regarded as a conventional anti-communist organization and accepted, in fact invited, into all sorts of places. I was invited to address Rotary clubs, other meetings, all over the place. This was quite different. A deep nerve had been touched. We were now dealing with the real forces behind the communist movement, and so that had to be destroyed. And it was during that period we moved towards the end of the 60s, where the Liberal Country Party, as it was known, coalition government, was running into increasing difficulties because of the state of the economy, particularly the effect in the rural communities and the start of the rural crisis. The campaign against the League now was intensified, and a study of the forces would require a whole chapter on its own. But quite clearly, the League now was regarded as a major force, a major threat, not only in other parts of the old British world, but also mainly here in Australia. And so as we come to an end of that decade, the 1960s, the League was in that position. And what took place afterwards, which I'll describe in my next talk, simply demonstrated the League at least had touched some very raw nerves. And now the League of Rights was a major factor, a major talking point in Australian politics. It was during this period the League was making tremendous progress inside the rural communities and largely inside what was then the Country Party. Up until this time, the League of Rights was, as I've said, was acceptable. Prominent Country Party politicians were very grateful to chair League meetings. In Queensland, for example, Sir Robert Sparks, who later became a major opponent of the League, he was quite happy to chair meetings and much else. But the Country Party was now faced with the grassroots movement, which in essence was saying the Country Party itself had policies which were highly commendable. Now, I might just say at this stage that the basis of British representative government was never one of mere numbers as such. It was based upon the concept that inside society there were different interests and they're all entitled to be represented. So the fact that the rural community is a minority doesn't alter the fact it's entitled to be effectively represented, particularly if it's most vital contribution to society. Every historian knows that. And so many of its policies, if you'll go back, were highly commendable from the beginning. Not many people realise that the Country Party originally concentrated on a program of decentralisation. It advocated, in fact, the creation of new states in accordance with proposals inside the Federation. And the League itself was involved in many of those movements. I personally was invited to attend the biggest new state movement, which was in New England, with prominent Country Party representative, the Honourable David Drubbin, being one of the leading figures. But also, the League was drawing attention to some of the financial policies of the Country Party, such as long-term, low-interest finance, which rural communities need, and much else. All the League was doing was drawing attention to the Country Party's own policies. This resulted in a most incredible reaction. Even the suggestion that the League of Rights was trying to take over the Country Party. All the League was trying to do was to point out to its members there was an answer to their problems, and it would be found in the policies of their own party. This resulted in a campaign unlashed with tremendous intensity through the Country Party by what we can only call the hierarchy of those people nationwide who saw the League as a threat. And so the Country Party during this period was used as the spearhead of a campaign of smearing the League. And that dominated Australian politics, not only during that period, but for many years to come. Anybody that cares to examine it, and has been examined, will find the influences that were there. It had a tremendous effect inside the Country Party and continued to have an effect inside its successor, the National Party. It's a very significant part of Australian history. And regretfully, that influence has continued through the successors of the Country Party, the National Party. And perhaps some social scientist somewhere will study this influence and how it managed to operate. But it did demonstrate that the League of Rights work was being effective, its influence was growing, and therefore those that had the other philosophy of life were determined it should be killed as quickly as possible. And that is where we reached that interesting period in the early 70s in Australian history.